Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network. Hey, Tom, welcome back.
Hey, John, always good to be with you.
I wouldn't think of you as the kind of guy that would want to come on and talk about something that includes the benefits of doing less, Tom.
I'm not sure I agree with it, John. It's just another clickbait for people that I think were creating something out of nothing, so I figured it was worth talking about.
Yeah, but this is the Wall Street Journal we're talking about. Try hard, but not that hard. 85% is the magic number for productivity. What's that all about?
Well, I think what it says is that it, like a machine, if you run everything at 100% all the time, it's going to wear out sooner. And that if you don't give it, if you're not pushing into the red zone every single minute, that maybe you'll be able to have higher output for a longer period of time and have more consistency for when you need to go up. And I think there's something to that, but it's usually based on the business cycle, not based on the individual.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, the question is, when do you give 85%?
Right.
When do you give 95%?
And how do we know when to program ourselves and to do that? It's one of these things that says, you know, I believe that the real meaning behind the theory, getting away from the actual article in the journal, is you've got to take care of yourself, right? If you run a machine that's never taken care of, never have the oil change or maintenance checks done on it, and you run it at 100% all the time, it will wear out sooner. And I think our bodies and our minds are the exact same thing. And so I don't know if any of us go at 100% or 85% or what have you, but I do know that if you don't take care of yourself emotionally and physically, that you do get some wear and tear on it a little bit more than you should.
Companies are offering their employees unlimited time off. They just take personal time, and whenever they need it, they take it. And then the idea is we won't keep score and it'll all even out in the end. As a result, though, there are some employees who don't take the amount of vacation they used to take. I wonder what you would say about that. Do you want your employees to take all of the time off that they can get?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, I don't like the way you phrased it. Should they take all the time off that they should get? I think that they should take off the time that they need, and I think they should take off the time that they want, but I think they also have to have a mature understanding of what the business is. And I tell you, the analogy I would tell you, John, is if you've got a hobby of liking golf and you want to golf all the time, you should golf as much as you can until it's detrimental on your marriage.
or detrimental on your business, I mean, or your employment.
Or whatever it is. But my point is that, you know, in our relationships, we usually run it that way, right? I want to party and I want to go drink a million beers and watch the football game until it's detrimental to me waking up early on Monday to go to work, or until I sleep through dinner with my family on Sunday night because, right? It's we treat work in these articles and online like it's something different than any other relationship or to-do that we have, and it's not. Yeah, the biggest difference is it's the only thing we do that we actually get compensated for. And so when you're doing something that you get compensated, you have to make sure that the delivery meets the demands and the needs. At the same time, you've got to figure out how to measure to keep yourself healthy, and that's the balance. But when you try to look like, hey, I'm going to set the rules for everything, and somebody else is going to pay me based on what I want to do, We're starting at the wrong end of the road.
There's a piece in the journal. 85% is the magic number for productivity. A nice twist on that from Tom Gimbel from the LaSalle Network. Okay, Tom.
Hey, John, just out of curiosity, if your kid told you when you went to pay for them to go to college, hey, Dad, I'm going to work at 85% of my maximum output for my grades, what would you say?
Well, that requires a nuanced answer, Tom. I mean, you just told me I would tell my kid, don't burn yourself out. I don't want you up until 2 in the morning studying. At the end, you're going to crash and burn. You're not going to enjoy college. Maybe you wouldn't get the best grades. So maybe 85% is, in fact, the new 100%. That's the best way to get the best grades. Your thoughts?
I think we should talk about it next week.
Thanks, Tom. Philip Weiss is the president of SciFarth at Work. Philip, you normally talk to us about something almost personal, what it's like for the lives of employees and employers. It seems to me today like you've got something broader in scope, merger mania. Why is that on your radar?
It is, John, because a lot of business owners are calling us with two interesting developments on their minds. The first is they're getting calls from bigger companies making offers to buy their own firms or organizations. And that's something we haven't seen a lot of due to the pandemic and economic uncertainty. So the market for mergers and acquisitions, it seems to be coming back to life with a real jolt. We saw some indicators that companies joining together was on the rise already last quarter, but now it's really picking up steam. The reason this, as you point out, is kind of a big picture problem is while it's great to have companies looking to grow, when they don't plan carefully, particularly when there's this sudden deal ramp up like we're seeing now, many mergers end up failing. And that's always a risk. You know, it's never a sure thing when two different companies join up. But when it happens as sort of almost a gunshot wedding approach, the risks are even greater, and that's what we're monitoring right now.
Before I ask you more about those details, can you just reflect on what that means about the economy in general?
Yeah.
Is this a good sign or a bad sign that Company X is buying up Company Y?
Yeah. Generally speaking, it's actually a very promising sign. Certainly one factor, John, as you might imagine, is the relatively still low interest rates on loans. You know, that can drive companies to think, okay, we want to do it now when we can get the funds that we need at a lower cost. But it also means, to your point, John, they see opportunity. They don't see their industry as one that's contracting, because if they did, they would not want to risk by buying and investing in another concern. So while there are efficiencies that can be built into a merger or a purchase, the reality is business owners have to see a stable or growing marketplace in many cases to take that next step.
So then what are the mistakes that businesses make that are on either side of this equation?
Yeah, so what's perhaps surprising to some is it's rarely the compatibility of the products or the services that is the death knell of a merged company. Far more often, John, it's the compatibility or incompatibility of the people and the failure of executives and the deal planners to look at the two environments and the way people engage and are treated and are managed and ask themselves a simple question, can these groups and these methods truly be matched and work together? So it can be as simple as the way salespeople are commissioned. We work with a marketing company. They purchased a competitor and found they could not get buy-in around their commission structure because the people who came in thought it was just too cutthroat and competitive for the salespeople to be fighting one another for bits and pieces of commission. That, interestingly, led to bad-mouthing of the company, of the newly merged company, in front of clients and potential customers, and that caused the deal to ultimately fall apart. Another quick example, John, is there's a local, very trendy Chicago-based clothing designer, and they agreed to merge with a much larger, in fact, global fashion label. And the small company, being entrepreneurial, looking for the next big thing in fashion, had allowed its designers to have 2-3 hours a day just to think freely, to let their minds wander and come up with the next great fashion innovation. That was anathema to the way a much larger company could manage or would manage at scale. That inability, unwillingness to let people have this unsupervised thinking, imagining time led to wholesale departures of the newcomers. So it can be as simple as looking at the way people are managed, what they value in how they're managed, and asking, is it compatible?
That's more what I thought you'd be talking about when you talk about different corporate cultures. Company X lets people pop a beer on Friday. Company Y would never do that. Are you running into those sorts of incompatibility issues as well?
Yeah, and that's a really great example, John, because sometimes it is as simple and as seemingly inconsequential as the way people kick back and relax. So, for example, we work with a tech client. This was actually a year ago now, so it's before this current rush to merge. But the story is exactly on point, given your question. The merged, the acquired company executives who became upper-level managers and lower-level execs at the new company, they were very much of that milieu, of that mindset where 2 p.m. is considered happy hour, and let's go to the bar and let's continue working with a beer in our hand. Totally unacceptable to a much larger company with a strict code of conduct. They also were the flip, sort of flip-flop and T-shirt set as well. So how they looked in front of the clients, how they engaged in terms of afternoon traditions was a real deal breaker. And it's a pity that you have to unravel, sell, or break apart a company that you brought in the hopes that you would grow together.
Well, it's something beyond the spreadsheets to pay attention to when you, again, are on either side of this. Philip Weiss, president of Cyfarth at Work. Okay, Philip, always interesting. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks for having me, John.
Do you think that when you use your credit card, somebody has to pay the processing charge or fee for that? And should it be you, or should it be the merchant, or should there even be a processing charge to use your credit card? Okay, let's talk about that now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Matt Schultz. Matt, you're on WGN. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Matt's with LendingTree. He's the chief credit analyst. How does that work? What is the fee? Who pays it? Just tell me how that is.
Well, generally what happens is that every time somebody swipes a credit card or uses a card online, merchants pay anywhere between 1.5% to 3.5% to 4% to card networks and to card issuers, basically for the privilege of accepting the credit card. And, you know, that's a lot of money off of the bottom line for merchants, so they don't like it very much. So what we're seeing more and more often now is them tacking on a surcharge that covers the amount of that fee that they have to pay, so they can kind of pass that on to the consumer.
Is the reverse of that true, too? That is, maybe they've marked the item up 2%, but they'll give you a 2% discount if you are paying with cash.
It can, yeah. And they can also obviously include the price, include that processing fee in the pricing as well. So there are a few different ways they can go about it.
And what about that? I mean, so is that fair? Is that a fair charge for somebody to pay?
Well, it makes sense. What makes it an interesting thing is that what is being done makes sense depending on your perspective, because the folks who process the cards need to make money to keep their businesses going. And the merchants have the right to be upset about how high those fees are, and the consumers have the right to be a little annoyed that those costs get passed on when they're probably already in the price. So it makes it all a really difficult situation, but what it comes down to is that you're probably going to see more and more of these credit card surcharges, because recent court rulings have said that in most of the country, you can do them as long as you tell people that you're going to.
I don't know that I've been told that, to be honest with you. I swipe my card all the time. In Illinois, should the merchant be obligated? Are they obligated to telling me, hey, you just paid 2% extra because you used your credit card, or whatever the percent is?
Well, generally, it's not like a verbal thing that they have to tell you. Typically, what it is they have to put some signage like near the door, if you're talking about a brick and mortar place, mm-hmm. near the door and near the checkout counter, saying that we're charging you a little bit extra if you pay with plastic. Then if it's just an online merchant, they have to put something on the checkout page. So nobody has to tell you verbally that they're doing it, but they do have to have some signage in, you know, reasonable places to let people know. Mm.
Well, thank you for that. I'll start to look for it and be upset in the future. But I don't know that I have much. I guess I could use my debit card, right? Would I get around it with my debit card then?
Potentially, because the costs for the merchants are a little cheaper when somebody uses a debit card. And the other thing that you can do is you can just ask the person behind the counter if they would be willing to waive that charge, because they might, especially if you're somebody who's a regular. Can't hurt to ask.
Is it capped at a certain point? Sometimes I make a purchase with a credit card and it's relatively inexpensive, and then I feel bad because it would seem to me like they're not making a lot of money to begin with. In fact, there have been times where I said, do you mind if I use my credit card, knowing full well I'm going to take 2% out of their pocket? And I'm wondering if, say it was a $2,000 purchase, though. Well, that's $40, right? I wonder if at some point the fee caps out, because how much more work was it for the processor anyway? A charge is a charge. Is there ever a ceiling on those fees, do you know?
Generally, the ceiling is that, in terms of like surcharges, the ceiling is that you can't charge the consumer more than you are paying in the fee. So it can't be like a profit center. It's basically just recouping those costs.
Okay, but it could be then whatever the purchase price is times whatever the rate is. You pointed out that there are surveys done which say that the vast majority of card holders, that would be you and me, don't realize it, but also are not certain that they think this should even be legal. Am I reading that correct?
Yeah. What we found is that in a survey that we just did, we found that 57% of card holders think that it should be illegal for merchants to be to charge these processing fees to consumers. And that was a pretty striking thing, I thought, because it's one thing to just not like it. It's a whole other thing to make it illegal. That's a big step. And it's frankly something that's not going to happen anytime soon. But it certainly underlines the anger and the dislike that people have for these charges.
Yeah, right. Well, I suppose that would be exacerbated if you thought that the merchant was making money off of that. That is, it was a 2.5% charge and they charged you 3%. I've always thought it was just a pass-through and nobody likes it, but I'm not sure that they should have to bear it. But I would like, I mean, I always appreciate when it seems like a little bit of a shell game, but when they say, we will, you'll see this sign sometimes, discounted if you're paying with cash or check. Right? I mean, that's not uncommon either, is it?
No, it's not. And it's certainly something that folks can do. And it really is something that the consumer does have options. They can potentially use cash. They can go shop somewhere else that may not charge them that. Or again, you can ask them if they'd waive it. You know, it really is kind of up to you how you want to handle it.
But I guess the bottom line here is, to the degree of you, based on your survey, that think this is wrong, don't expect any legislative relief. That is the way the industry works right now.
That's correct. And if anything, it's probably going to become more common, because we've seen court rulings recently that have essentially invalidated some of these laws, state laws, against these sorts of surcharges. So now there's only a couple of states in the country where you can't do it.
Matt Schultz is a LendingTree chief credit analyst, LendingTree.com. Okay, Matt, thanks for the heads up on that.
All right, thank you.
More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Candy maker Ferrero today opens its first North American Research and Development Lab and Innovation Center in the Marshall Fields Building in downtown Chicago. Grand opening was scheduled for today at 24 East Washington. Ferrero's food scientists will research and develop new products. The center includes facilities where workers will conduct taste tests and evaluate the properties of new items. The ninth floor center will be a hub for development of North American products. It marks the first time candy production has happened in the building since Marshall Fields and its Prango Mints moved out in 1999. The most recent contract offered by Stellantis to the United Auto Workers includes a plan to repurpose the company's Belvedere plant into a parts hub. The facility was idled earlier this year, and about 1,300 workers were laid off. The proposal calls for the plant to become a mega hub parts center. Union members are seeking more information about the number of positions that might be created and whether it would be as many as a vehicle production facility. The plant previously made the Jeep Cherokee. There's also been mention of the facility making electric vehicle battery components. I'm Steve Grtanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time. Here's Steve Alexander.
Thank you. Here's a sound we don't hear much anymore. Yeah, the ka-ching of the cash register has been replaced by beeps and other digital payment sounds. But however it sounds, food prices are still going up. More about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado HD for sponsoring us. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Over the past 20 years or so, food prices have gone up, on average, about 2% per year. But last year, food exploded, an average of 11.5% higher than what we paid in 2021. This year, prices are moderating. USDA economist Matt McLaughlin has the numbers.
We don't really expect to be going over 6% in terms of food at home prices.
And McLaughlin says for most of the first half of the year, it looked like food prices were stabilizing, allowing him to lower his forecast for the full year. Until last month.
We increased our forecast from a little under 5% increases to a little bit over 5% increases.
That does include what we pay for away from home foods, but for food we buy at the store?
Price increases between 4.4% and 6.1%.
And you know, we can't blame eggs anymore. Prices of the incredible edible ovals have continued to go down. Beef is now the reason.
Our price forecast for beef this year increased from 2.7% to 4.2%, which reflects a 2.4% increase between June and July in beef and veal prices.
And that's because
there's a shortage of cattle right now that's driving up cattle prices, and that's being passed along.
So we are paying about 5% more for our food this year, and the forecast for next year?
2.1%, closer to what we observe over the last 20 years as an annual percentage price increase.
So not unusual inflation, not deflation, it's
disinflation.
From the farm to your belly, today's National Butterscotch Pudding Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Earth produces about 400 million tons of plastic every year. Less than 10% of it is recycled. Evergreen Climate Innovations and Nicor Gas partner to support underrepresented entrepreneurs that make a positive environmental impact here in Illinois. And the 2023 Nicor Gas Multicultural Innovator Award winner is on the phone line. That's Dr. Ryan Hackler, the CEO and co-founder of Eternal Upcycling. Ryan, you're on WGN. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So what's upcycling? How is that different from recycling?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think of... I apologize. There might be sirens in the background.
It's all right. I can hear you.
All right. So recycling, as we commonly know it, is essentially recreating the same plastic material from what we started with. And upcycling is instead taking that same waste plastic and creating something of higher value. And so that's what we're focused on.
I see. So you're not melting it down and starting all over. Whatever the plastic is that I've turned in, you're going to do something compositionally with the same stuff, huh?
Exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of good technologies, a lot of good companies and people trying to recreate plastic, because the reason why we have 400 million tons of plastic produced every year is because we use it in absolutely everything. That being said, that's not exactly the easiest job to do economically, to create value out of something that has the same value as what you end up with as what you started. And so what we're doing with upcycling is saying instead, there's a certain value associated with this plastic material. Let's turn it into something higher value. And so that's what upcycling is all about.
So what's an example of something you produce as a result?
Absolutely. So we can take your bubble wraps, plastic bags, water bottles, utensils, these single-use plastic materials that we use day in, day out, and then have no regard for them and just toss them. We can turn that into waxes for cosmetics, for pharmaceuticals, for coatings of various food-grade applications. We can turn it into motor oil for your car, even for your electric vehicle. Not everybody knows this, but electric vehicles also use a type of motor oil. It's a bit different than what you typically use for your combustion engine, and you don't have to replace it as often, but they still use that type of material. And if we're even looking at green applications, such as wind turbines, you know, trying to put to a more sustainable energy generation apparatus, those wind turbines use a ton of gearbox oil as well, and those are traditionally produced from petroleum refineries.
Yeah.
And so basically what we're trying to do is find a means of establishing a more sustainable option for these materials that we use day in, day out that come from, you know, plastic waste.
Okay, I got one more question, and then we'll have another conversation like this another day when we have a little more time and we have a better connection. But what can our listeners do if I want, like, I'm recycling. I'm not confident my recycling in Chicago goes anywhere useful. Is there anything we as listeners or consumers can do to be part of this?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say first and foremost, I think everybody, when they hear that, oh, the plastic waste that you put on a recycling bin, most of it doesn't actually get recycled, that's very disheartening. I would say, first and foremost, continue to do that, even if right now the recycling rate across the country is pretty poor, to be honest. That is improving. Companies like myself and others, we are trying to find a means to get that plastic waste and having everybody listening on air start establishing that behavior early on so it becomes second nature to you. That way it makes it all the easier when we start pushing up that recycling rate, because that's going to be all the more important to make this actually sustainable and actually achievable.
And we need to bring you into the studio sometime. I'm going to show you all the plastics that I'm throwing out, and you tell me what the applicability is of these. But that's another day. Dr. Ryan Hackler, thank you for joining us, the CEO and co-founder of Eternal Upcycling. It's spelled A-E-T-E-R-N-A-L, Eternal with an A first, eternalupcycling.com. Doc, thanks for joining us. We'll have another conversation another day.